Welcome to the Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by X2 Comedy. If you're looking to get more out of your Shenandoah Valley experience, then this is the podcast for you. You'll meet interesting people, musicians, and comedians that perform here and find out more about what you can do and see. Whether you live here or plan to visit, listen to explore what makes our unique slice of heaven. Now here's your host, Don Davis Womack.
Hello, laughers. Welcome to another exciting episode of our podcast where we explore the fascinating world of art and culture. Today, we have the privilege of interviewing a visionary leader and the executive director of the Quilt Museum in Harrisonburg, Virginia, Alicia Thomas. With a profound passion for quilting and a dedication to preserving and celebrating this rich heritage, Alicia has played a pivotal role in shaping the Quilt Museum into a thriving hub of creativity and inspiration. Through her tireless efforts, she has transformed the museum into a vibrant space that showcases the intricate artistry and cultural significance of quilts. Join us as we delve into Alicia's journey, her invaluable contributions, and the captivating world of quilting. Founded in 1995, the Virginia Quilt Museum is the official quilt museum of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Welcome to the show, Alicia. It's great to have you on today.
Thank you so much for having me, Dawn. I'm thrilled to be here with you.
This is so exciting. The first thing that you did when you met me today is you took me on this great tour of the Quilt Museum, and it's been a while since I've been here, and there are still fabulous exhibits, but a lot of new things that I had not seen before. Some of them include the room with all the historical sewing machines, mm-hmm. and learning about that, exhibits that are more like art pieces than actual quilts, baby quilts. There's so much to see here. And I was already excited to come do this today, but now I'm even more excited. So I think we should just get into it. What do you think?
That sounds great, Dawn.
Let's do it. First question for you is, can you tell us about your personal journey and how you became involved with the Quilt Museum?
Definitely. So my background is actually in museums and in history. So I grew up in Southern Michigan and went to Michigan State University when we were chatting on our tour. And we were actually both living in East Lansing and Lansing at the same time because your husband was teaching there.
It's crazy.
And yeah. In my alternate universe, we knew each other. So I have a bachelor's degree from Michigan State in American history. And then I knew pretty quickly I didn't want to go into teaching. That was not something I was interested in. So started looking for different ways to use my history degree and kind of stumbled into museums. I honestly don't even remember how, but spent my junior year of college actually in Charleston, South Carolina, interning at the Charleston Museum with the curator of history and fell in love with museums. So then got my master's degree in public history from the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Public history can cover a lot of things. It's really geared towards historians that don't want to work in academia. So my specific program really focused on museum studies and historic preservation. I had the unfortunate timing of graduating right in the middle of the Great Recession.
Oh my gosh.
So I got my master's degree in 2008, and the economy was just tanking. And not only were there not jobs, there really weren't museum jobs. I mean, nonprofits got hit hard with the recession. So I was just kind of looking for anything kind of in the Mid-Atlantic region. My, at the time, boyfriend, who's now my husband, was going to grad school at the University of Delaware. So I was trying to be somewhere near him. And ended up getting a job in Washington, D.C. at the Capitol Visitor Center as a visitor assistant, and was just happy to have a full-time job with benefits that paid enough that I could managed to live. And ended up being there for about 5 years, but really wanted to get back into museums, and ended up taking a job in Philadelphia at a small museum working in visitor services, and worked my way up from there into working in fundraising and membership. Then my husband and I moved back to DC, and I actually took a couple years off from museums and worked in other nonprofits. I was an operations manager for a small nonprofit, but really missed museums. And so started looking for a new job in late 2020, which was an interesting time to be looking for a museum job. A lot of museums were still closed.
Yeah.
And we're still kind of reeling from the pandemic at that time.
Right.
And I wasn't in a rush to find a job. I was okay with the job I was in, but wanted to get back into the museum field. And then I think June of 2021 saw the advertisement for the executive director position here at the Virginia Quilt Museum. And I didn't even know where Harrisonburg was. I just like saw this job posting on one of the museum job boards. And I was like, this is right up my alley. I love really small museums. It's my preference. I like being able to have my hands and fingers in all of the pies. And I really love women's history. Like that's what speaks to me the most. It's what I can relate to the most. And so I was like, well, quilting, that seems great. I know a little bit about quilting. My mom quilts. My grandmother quilted. I remember like sitting under a quilting frame at my church with my grandmother quilting when I was a small child. And so somehow convinced my husband that we could move to rural Virginia and applied for the job and then got my first interview. And I was like, I guess we should go to this town.
Hey, laughers, Tisha here. You know what goes great with this podcast? Free Popsters Gourmet Popcorn. We're so excited to sponsor this podcast, highlighting some of the most wonderful people in the Shenandoah Valley. To show our love for you laughers, we're giving you 15% off today at prepopsters.com. That's PrePopsters.com. Use promo code LAUGH15.
And so we came over and visited and fell in love with it. Mm. And then I was like, oh, I really hope I get this job. And I did. And so then we ended up moving here in September of 2021. And I started working here that fall. And I've loved it ever since.
That's magnificent. Well, I'm glad you fell in love with us and that you're here now.
Yeah. It's working out really well for us.
I think so. I'm interested in what you just mentioned about your love for women's history. What inspired that for you?
I mean, I think part of it is just it's what I can most easily relate to as a woman myself. Like that's how I view the world. But also just my personal family history of women. My dad's mother served in the Navy in World War II. Wow. And then she was a school teacher by trade, but left teaching to serve in the Navy. And then right after World War II, actually spent a year teaching abroad in Scotland, and then spent the summer of, I believe, 1947 biking around Europe. Okay. On her own.
Oh, wow.
As a single woman in still what would have been war-ravaged Europe.
Right.
And one of my biggest regrets is that she developed Alzheimer's when I was very young. And so that's all I know about that story. And she didn't write anything down. She didn't keep a journal. And I'm just like, what a remarkable story that's completely lost.
Right.
You know, we're never going to know what she saw. And just how many stories like that are out there from women that we're never going to know. And quilts are one of the ways we can tell that story. Mm-hmm. We can look at quilts and we can take some educated guesses about the women that made them. Mm-hmm. We can see if they were using really nice fabric or kind of cheaper fabric. So we can guess what their socioeconomic status was. We can look and see if they're using scraps and kind of using whatever they had, or if it's all matching fabric. So they had the time and the money to go buy fabric specifically to make a quilt. So we can kind of pull out little pieces of their history with quilts.
Oh, neat.
And that is one of the reasons why I love museums and why I love women's history, is kind of teasing out those stories and those facts that we can kind of discover through objects.
That's a beautiful answer.
Thank you. I really love that.
I am so curious about her story too.
I know. It's one of those things, like I think I was 10 or 11 when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and she'd been ill before that. So I was just too young to ask the questions. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
It's so important to capture history and the stories,
mm-hmm.
because it tells us so much about where we've come from and what went right and what went wrong.
Yeah.
So that we can create a better future and keep growing and developing. It's magnificent. So I'm glad you're here now so we can talk about some of what we can has lived on through the pieces that you have exhibited here.
So yeah.
That's really good stuff. The Quilt Museum has become a prominent institution in the field. What were some of the challenges the museum has faced over its time in establishing and growing itself as a presence here?
Yeah. So a lot of the challenges we've faced are just the challenges that all small nonprofits face. Our operating budget this year is just under $250,000. So we're pretty small. We have two full-time staff. I'm full-time. I have a full-time curator, Kate Reed. And then I've got two part-time staff. But that's it as far as staff. We outsource our bookkeeping and our marketing and social media. So we get really great support from those. But $250,000 is nothing to run a museum on, especially we're located in a historic building. Our building was built in 1856. So it constantly needs attention. It's the second biggest line item in our budget besides salaries is our building and our utilities and upkeep. And it also has challenges. We're not fully handicap accessible, unfortunately, because we're in a historic building. We don't have an elevator. Our lower level and our main floor are accessible, but our top floor is not. It's only accessible via stairs. But other than that, it's just getting people to know we're here. So things like this podcast are great for us, but also finding the money for advertising so that we can tell people we're here and what we're doing. And then on top of that, getting people to know that we're for people who aren't quilters. So quilters are always going to be kind of our bread and butter visitors. They're going to be the people that take special day trips to come see us. And we love them. We wouldn't exist without them. They are our members. They are our biggest supporters. But we can't exist just to serve quilters. Nor do we want to. We want to draw new people into quilting. We also want to teach people to appreciate quilting as an art form. And so you saw some of the exhibits that
yes.
we have. They're definitely art. They're not made to be bed coverings or traditional quilts. They are modern art quilts. So teaching people that part of quilting, which is honestly not a thing I knew about until I took this job. I started here and I was like, surely I know what quilting is. Like, I've been around it. And then I was like, oh, I know nothing about quilting. And it's been very humbling, but also great. The quilting community is super supportive. No one has ever been like mean that I don't have a background in quilting. They're so great and so willing to share resources and help teach me. It's just been wonderful.
Yeah, there's so much in there I want to touch on too. Thanks for sharing that. Number one, the history of this building mm-hmm. is pretty magnificent. There's even, if you go on your website, it gives you a little history book almost on the various ways this home has been used, including being a Civil War hospital.
Yeah. So the building, it's the Warren Sipe House. And so it's named after the Warren and the Sipe family. So the Warren family is the family that built the building in 1856. It was built by Edward Warren. He became an officer in the Confederacy. He unfortunately did not survive the war. He was killed at the Battle of Wilderness in 1864. So he almost made it. Not quite.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah.
But yeah, after the Battle of Gettysburg, the Confederacy retreated through the valley down basically what's now 80, Interstate 81 was their retreat route from Gettysburg. And so there were hospitals here in Harrisonburg for the wounded. Where City Hall was the main one. They were overflowing, so they ended up using the Warren House as a hospital. We do know of one soldier who passed away here in the house. He is who our supposed ghost is.
Okay.
His name was Joseph Latimer. He was only 19. He was a major in the Confederacy. He had been shot in the arm at Gettysburg and had a field amputation, and then gangrene set in, and that's what ultimately killed him. We affectionately call him Jojo, our friendly ghost.
Okay.
And we blame him when things go wrong.
Jojo.
So like we had a security alarm go off the other night, and I was like, what's Jojo doing? It was probably just like a mouse running across and setting off a sensor. But yeah, Jojo's who we blame when things like that happen, or sometimes quilts fall off the wall. Okay. And so we're like, oh, Jojo didn't like that one.
Has anybody seen him?
I have not. And okay. I don't think anyone on my current staff has. Okay. I think some past staff that I've talked to have had experiences, but they can share their stories if they like.
Yes. One of my friends, Lisa Hawksmith, used to live in Harrisburg. She lives in Charlottesville now. But she has done the Harrisonburg ghost tours. Around, you know, mid-October through Halloween. And she actually did them again this last year, and I came out to support and help her. We stopped by here and she talked about that.
Yeah.
So it is part of the ghost tour if any of you laughers ever want to take it. Then you can see and hear the story for yourself and about Jojo.
Yeah. And we're in the process. We are supposed to have a Civil War trail sign outside the museum. Before I started here, it was actually hit by a car and broke into many pieces. But we're working with the Civil War Trails to get a new sign. It's in production right now. So hopefully by this fall, we'll have a new sign for the Civil War Trails out front that talks about the history of it as a Confederate hospital and about Joseph. So.
Oh, that's really great. This is the magnificent pieces that you have in here. We are going to be talking about that. I'm wondering, how do you curate the exhibits here at the Quilt Museum?
Yeah, so we do exhibits in a couple different ways. We always have exhibits from our permanent collection on display. And so those we curate here in-house. So either my curator, Kate Reed, does those, or I try and do about one a year just to dip my toe into the curation pond. It's also a fun part of my job, curating. So one of the things we do is we look at our exhibit calendar and see what else we're going to have on display at that time and try and pick something that complements it. And so whether that's this fall, I'm curating a Civil War quilts exhibit. And one of the reasons I'm doing that is we're actually having a contemporary exhibit by an artist named Leslie Riley, who she uses historic photographs and makes beautiful art quilts that tell different stories. And she's doing them focused on civilians in the Civil War.
Oh, neat.
So I was like, it would be really great if we had some of our Civil War era quilts out to complement that exhibit. From there, once we have a topic, a lot of our curation process is around the space we have. Since we're in a historic building, we don't just have big, empty, blank walls. So we have to take into account radiators and mantelpieces and windows. So it's what actually fits in the space we have for that exhibit. And sometimes we'll fold quilts so that you're not seeing the whole thing so that it'll fit. But then it's also the story we want to tell. So right now we have up an exhibit called Quilts Gone Wild,
yes.
Which you got to see.
Yes.
And it's really fun. So it's just a fun take on so many different quilt patterns are named after animals. So there's ducks in a pond, there's goose tracks, there's bear paw. So it's just a way of looking at the quilts based on that as opposed to based on color or size or when they were made. So it all depends on kind of what we're trying to achieve and what space we're working with.
Okay. Yeah. So that brings in part of my next question mm-hmm. or answer to it, which is what factors do you consider when selecting quilts for display? So that's the complementary piece of mm-hmm. what do we have going on. What other factors do you consider when selecting quilts for display?
So also what we have and their condition. So we do have some quilts in our permanent collection that are too fragile to display. We have some that we have to display flat. So upstairs in Quilts Gone Wild, we had that eagle quilt that was on a table. It's too fragile to hang, but we can get away with displaying it flat. Other than that, some of them, it's aesthetic. What's aesthetically pleasing? What looks good next to each other? Last summer, we were installing an exhibit and we were hanging a quilt that we had never hung before. And we put it on the wall and we were like, oh no, this quilt is not square and it's off by like 13 or 14 inches and it looks awful. Like, oh, it just, and there's no way to make this right. So we ended up swapping it out at the last minute with a different quilt that told the same story we were going for. So sometimes it's things like that. And when you're talking about historic quilts, those things happen where things weren't exactly square. And then over 150 years, they've gotten even worse. But then it's also sometimes if we don't have things in our collection, we'll reach out to our members or to private collectors and say, hey, we're doing an exhibit on this topic. Do you happen to have anything that will fill this hole? So last fall, I did a medallions exhibit. So with central medallions, but we didn't have enough in our collection to do a full exhibit for the space we wanted. So I just reached out to our members and said, hey, like in just a monthly email, has anyone made any medallion quilts they'd be willing to loan us? And I think we ended up with pieces from three different quilters that are members of the museum. And it took what I had originally imagined as a completely historic exhibit and made it a blend of historic and contemporary pieces.
Oh, cool.
So then it was really nice to be able to juxtapose those pieces right next to each other. Like, here's a medallion quilt from 1810. Here's one from 2010 right next to it. And look at the similarities and look at the differences.
Okay, here's where I'm going to need just a little bit of education. And I imagine there's some laughers out there that are wondering the same exact question. And that is, what is a medallion? It sounded significant.
Yeah.
I was like,
It's a style of quilt.
Yeah.
The really basic answer is there's some form of central theme with mini borders around it.
Okay, and what would the central theme example be?
Sometimes it is just a quilt block. Sometimes it's often a design of some sort. So it could be something like a flower. We have a really great kind of 1990s one that is, the quilt is called Appalachian Folk Dance, and the central medallion are dancing figures in a circle. And then there's numerous borders going out around that. We have a really great medallion quilt from 1810 that the center medallion is a fountain in a tree. It's a very historic thing that sounds very weird to describe, but it's beautiful. So medallions can be really anything, but a central focus and then many borders around them.
One more piece of education. What is a block for people? I've never heard that term before.
So quilt blocks are kind of the basic, I'm trying to think of the right words to use.
Isn't it like a square piece of fabric or something? Or
it is. So if you think of a traditional quilt, say a nine patch.
Okay.
Which a nine patch is where there are three rows of three squares.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
So in the nine patch, the block would be those nine squares sewn together.
Thank you.
So it's your basic building block
and
of a
pattern,
quilt.
Like your building pattern, mm-hmm. right? Okay.
And blocks can be anything. They can be a nine patch. They can be a bear paw. It can be an applique design that's a wreath. they aren't always square. Most of the time, they're either square or rectangular, but they don't have to be. Modern quilting, like the things you would see at like QuiltCon or some of the improv work that's being done, doesn't use blocks. But for a traditional quilting, they're the basis of quilting.
Thank you. That was very, very helpful, Alicia. Appreciate that. Quilting has such a rich history and cultural significance. How does the Quilt Museum educate visitors about the cultural context and stories behind the quilts on display?
So we try and do that in our exhibits through our signage. So we try and tell as much as we can about the quilts that we have. Sometimes that is almost nothing. Sometimes we just have a rough guess of when the quilt was made based on the fabrics and the style of the quilt. Other times we're lucky that it's been passed down through a family or through a chain of people and they've kept the history of the quilt with it. And so we know who made it, why it was made, when it was made, and then we're able to tell that story. Another thing we're doing, and just at the end of last year, our whole permanent collection is actually available online. So if you go to our website and go under collections, there's a button and you can go right into our actual, it's our collections database that we use to manage our collection. And you can see all of our quilts in there. We don't have all the information about all of our quilts in there. We're working on adding more information as we go, but there's basic information about all of our quilts. We're also doing a series of programs this year that we're calling Second Saturdays. So these are virtual programs where we rotate them between myself and Kate Reed, my curator, and each one is focused around a different topic. So in a couple of days, I'm doing one on log cabin quilts. So specifically looking at the log cabin pattern, showing off pictures of four or five of our quilts and talking about the history of that pattern in quilting. I would really love to also start recording those and having them available on our YouTube channel.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to try that this month.
Oh, brave, so. Alicia. You do it.
But then we also offer different programs. So we do teas. Yeah. We can do group tours, all sorts of those things to kind of help talk about the history and culture of quilting. I also go out to quilt guilds and give talks.
I love that. The YouTube channel. You have a YouTube channel?
We do. We're not very active on it.
All right.
But I have big plans for it.
Okay, good. So this is kind of dipping the toes into it to share the world of quilting with people.
Yeah. And if you are interested in quilting, I'll just plug, there's a great YouTube program called Textile Talks that's put on by some of the larger quilt organizations and museums across the country. And they're free. They're a weekly program.
Mm-hmm.
So there is really great content out there. We're hoping to start adding more to it, hopefully next year.
That'll be great. And you mentioned this log cabin mm-hmm. pattern. And I saw that when we were going through and you gave me a tour, which, again, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So log cabin, if you had to visually describe that to a laugher that may have never seen a log cabin pattern before, how would you describe it?
So log cabins are square blocks. And they start in the center of each square is a small square. A lot of times you'll traditionally see that square as red. It doesn't have to be. Some people say it symbolizes like the hearth of a log cabin, and that's why it's red. And then surrounding that central square, there are rectangular strips that just build out the block all the way around it. And one of the really fascinating things with log cabins is depending on how you place your colors within it, once you put all those blocks together, you can get at least 5 different looking quilts out of it.
Oh my gosh, that's
great. And it's just based on how you use color within that block. And it's fascinating to me because that is not how my mind works. Like, there is no way I'd ever be able to do that on my own. I would need someone to give me very specific instructions.
You and me both.
And it's one of, there are a lot of quilt patterns that when you look at them, it can be hard if you're not a quilter to pick out what the actual block is. Mm-hmm. And log cabins are one of those where, like, depending on how they've been put together, it's really hard to see what the actual block is depending on how the color goes. So it's just fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's fascinating. More fascinating to me now that I know that. I think the log cabin pattern has been around for a while, right?
Yeah, it dates back to the 1860s.
Okay.
Quilt patterns are tricky. They pre kind of 1900, they didn't have standardized names.
Okay.
It's really the early 1900s and the proliferation of quilting patterns being published in magazines and newspapers that we start to see some standardized names. But there has been, I'm blanking on the researcher's name. They have traced the log cabin pattern back to, I think, like 1863. It's a very traditional pattern. It's, from what I understand, not being a quilter myself, one of the easier patterns because it's all straight lines.
Yeah. See, and I never knew that before. That's one of the many reasons why I love doing this podcast is I get to learn so much fascinating and rich information from the guests. So thank you for that also. What are some unique or noteworthy exhibitions that have taken place at the Quilt Museum? Can you share a few highlights with us?
Yeah. So just this past winter until April, we were very lucky to have an exhibit of 14 quilts from Ginny Beyer. And Ginny Beyer is a world-renowned quilter who happens to be a Virginian. She was one of the people who really revived quilting in the 1970s. There was a very large quilt revival around the bicentennial in 1976. Ginny started a few years before that in, I want to say, 1972. She was the first quilter to have her own fabric line designed.
Wow.
She was inducted into the Quilters Hall of Fame in the 1980s. She's a huge deal in the quilting community. And just last year, she announced her retirement. So she had a studio and a fabric store in Great Falls, Virginia. And she closed down her studio and she stopped designing fabric. I think she's still got maybe one or two more lines coming out that were designed before she announced her retirement. And so we were very lucky that in honor of her retirement, we were able to have a exhibit of quilts that she's made and designed over the years. And we were the only museum to get it in the whole country.
In the whole country. That's great.
And I had at least three other museums reach out and be like, can you put us in touch? And I was like, I can, but she said no. So it was fantastic. Her quilting is extraordinary. I would just find myself sitting in the gallery staring at her quilts for hours being like, I just don't understand how she does this.
Oh my gosh. Well, can you give an example of her intricacy that fascinated you with her work?
She does a lot with tessellation. So where patterns repeat by just kind of rotating or flipping the pattern. So like triangles that are set with other triangles within them. And she also has a really unique sense of color and the use of color. But there was one quilt that she called Daylilies that I just, no matter how long I looked at it, I was like, I still just don't understand how you made this. Because it was like these curving pieces that ended in points and just getting all of these points to match up. And it, I think there were like 90 different fabrics in it.
Wow.
And yeah, her work is next level.
That's incredible. I don't even know if you know the answer to this question. Do you know or could take a rough guess of how many hours that might have taken her?
I don't, because also the other thing with Ginny Beyer is she does everything by hand.
Wow.
So she does all of her piecing and all of her quilting by hand. She doesn't use a machine. I know she's much faster than the average person, one of her most famous quilts is called Windows, and she started making it within a few weeks of the September 11th attacks. Mm-hmm. She was actually supposed to leave the country a few days after September 11th. all flights were stopped. So clearly that didn't happen. She also had a good friend who was in the Pentagon who did not survive. So she and her husband just kind of packed up their stuff and went over to the eastern shore of Maryland to have a little vacation. And she took some fabric and started designing and making this really beautiful quilt in remembrance of everyone that was lost on 9/11. And that took her just over a year. And it's big. It's roughly 90 by 90 inches. Don't quote me on that.
I won't.
But it's large. So she's working fast that she was able to piece that and quilt that all in a year. But yeah, still, that's a year's worth of work.
So do you have that piece?
We don't. She owns all of her quilts. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I would love to have a Jenny Byer piece in our collection, but we don't yet. Hopefully someday.
Yeah.
Besides her exhibit, some of the other really kind of fan favorite ones we've had recently, last year in 2021, we had Inspired by Endangered Species. That's a very large exhibit. I want to say it's 182 mini quilts. So they're each 24 by 24 inches, and each one depicted a different endangered species. And they took over the entire second floor of our museum. It took us almost a week to install them all.
Oh my gosh.
It was intense, but they were fantastic and people loved them. And some of them were so realistic that you like thought the otter was going to come out of that quilt and hug you.
Oh my gosh.
That exhibit was curated by a fantastic woman from Northern Virginia named Donna DeSoto. This is, I think, the fourth or fifth exhibit she's done like this, and we've been lucky to have all of them, where she picks a theme and she works with quilters around the nation to create these mini quilts, and then they go on display at different museums. There's always a book that goes with them. And one of the really nice things Donna does is she also always supports different causes with her project. So like for Endangered Species, some of the money she got from the sale of her books went to a conservation organization. So she was supporting endangered species through the exhibit and also just helping raise awareness of them.
That these books that the quilters basically have as a companion to their work, I've not really seen those before. So is it like the pictures of their work inside the book? Okay.
Yeah. So for Endangered Species, it was a picture of each quilt, but then also a little bit of information about the artist, but then also for those specifically, information about the endangered species and actions that people could take to help that species. So
I love that. I didn't even know about that. You're opening up my whole world with this quilting museum. It's not just a space for showcasing quilts, but also a hub for learning and community engagement. Can you tell us about the educational programs and initiatives offered by the museum?
Yeah. So we do not do as much as I would like, and part of that is our staffing. I would really love if we could add a third full-time staff member to do educational programming. But we do the Second Saturdays programs that I've already mentioned. We do teas a couple times a year, which I know don't sound like historic or learning opportunities, but they definitely are. Our teas always start with an hour-long presentation of quilts from our collection. And the nice thing with our teas is we limit them to 10 people each, so it's a really intimate experience, and you actually get to touch our historic quilts. So we have everyone put on gloves, we lay them out on a table, and we go through them and we talk about everything we know about the quilt. We answer questions, we get magnifying glasses and look at them. We also are starting to try and do more educational and kind of hands-on activities during some of the Harrisonburg festivals and events. So Best Weekend Ever is coming up in a couple weeks, and we have members of the Shenandoah Valley chapter of the American Needlepoint Guild coming that day, and they're going to be doing a make and take where kids can make a needlepoint bookmark and take with them we can teach some needlepoint just on the spot and hopefully get some people interested. But other than that, I really hope that we can start teaching some more classes. Pre-pandemic, we definitely taught more classes, and we just haven't quite gotten back in the swing of it. I would love to be teaching some like introductory level quilting classes and different techniques. I know in the past we've had a really popular indigo dyeing class that we kind of took over the back lawn. It's something you do outside. So all those sorts of things, we're hoping to expand our offerings.
Yeah, I think that's really great. I like the bookmark for the kids.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see how it goes. And the nice thing is that group has agreed to come to all of the festivals this year for us. So they'll be here for Best Weekend Ever, Skeleton Fest in October, and then also Winter Wonder Fest in December. So I don't know what specific activities they'll be doing for the other two, but I'm excited that we get to have some hands-on activities at those. Because those days we also do free admission. And so it's just like a big open house. And we generally get over 100 visitors on those days because downtown is just hopping and full of people.
Definitely. And our laughers, they expand the globe. So if this is your first time listening to the podcast, it's worth mentioning that Harrisonburg Downtown Renaissance is a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to the mission of revitalizing our downtown. And they put on those festivals mm-hmm. that you are talking about, and they are free.
Yeah.
So
I love HDR. They are huge supporters of the museum. Yeah. Last year, we were lucky to get a $5,000 grant from them to kind of renovate and revamp our second floor and create some new gallery spaces and get everything repainted. Their staff is also just incredibly helpful. They help promote the museum so much. They're constantly sharing our stuff on social media. I can't say enough good things about HDR. Come to the festivals, support them.
Absolutely. And if you're new again to the podcast, there are some podcast interviews with that team that mm-hmm. can give you more information about those festivals. And then make sure you stop by the Quilt Museum and see Alicia and her team, because they have this craft, this quilting craft. It bridges tradition and innovation. Alicia, how does the Quilt Museum foster creativity and support contemporary quilters and their artistic pursuits here?
One of the things we do with contemporary quilters is we do offer exhibition space for them. So right now we have two contemporary quilters on exhibit. We have the work of Lisa Ellis, who's a local Virginian. We have her Cathedral Windows exhibit. And then we also have work by Anna Chepa, who is, I believe, based out of Pennsylvania. And so we have an exhibit proposal process where anyone can submit a proposal to have their quilt exhibit here at the museum. That gets reviewed by a committee. And we would love to see proposals from anyone, whether that's a guild or a solo artist. One of the other things we try really hard to do is just be a resource for quilters. So whether that is research, anyone can come see any of our quilts. So if there's someone who's researching a quilt, whether that's a contemporary quilter who's looking for some inspiration or a researcher who's researching a project, if they reach out to us, we'll pull anything from our collection and pull it out for you and let you come look at it and tell you what we can. We also just try and be a space where quilters can come get inspiration so that they can come see other exhibits and come see what people are doing. And then for those that do have exhibits here, we promote them a lot on social media so that hopefully that's expanding their audience and their reach as well. We also offer folks to be able to sell stuff on consignment in our gift shop. So whether that's quilters or other local artisans, we do consignment sales so that artists can get support that way.
Yeah. There are really great artists in there. Laughers, you got to come here and in here and see what they have. There's one room where the fabric was like, I felt like I was walking through and seeing cityscapes. And
yeah, that's the work of Anna Chepa. She takes digital photographs and then photoshops them and manipulates them and prints that onto fabric and then quilts over it. And the detail she gets into where they're quilting, like she quilts like the lines of the siding into buildings and the window frames in, and then does these like beautiful leaf designs or other designs in the borders. And it's, yeah, her work is stunning and so unique. I've never seen anything else like what she's doing.
I would agree with that 150%. How long do you keep exhibits like that up? So
most of our exhibits are up anywhere between 9 and 12 weeks. Great. So we're open almost year round. We close for about 3 weeks at the end of the year. We generally close like December 23rd and open again around January 10th or 12th. So in those 3 weeks we're closed, it's the one time of year that we change out the whole museum. So when we open in January, everything is new. And then from there, we kind of start changing stuff out late March. By the end of April, everything's changed. So this round that's up now will be up through kind of early July. We'll change everything out again over the course of a month. Have those things up through, I think, October.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's really great. Now, there's other people out there that may be new to quilting, mm-hmm. and maybe want to try it. And you do have some beginning quilting classes, yeah?
At the moment, we don't have anything scheduled. I'm hoping to get some stuff scheduled for the fall. It's one of the things, I need to find a teacher. the person who has taught that for us in the past has had to kind of step back from teaching. She's building a new house and that's taking over her life.
Oh, darn it.
You know, and life happens like that. But that kind of beginning quilting, beginning technique classes is something I really want to get us back into, because our mission is to cultivate and preserve the quilting arts in Virginia. So we need to make sure that we are bringing in that next generation of quilters. And one of the best ways to do that is with classes teaching those beginning techniques.
Yeah, I think that would be really great. You have other events here that you put on that we may not have talked about yet?
I think we've talked about all that we have scheduled. There are others that I'm working on scheduling. So they're not on our website yet, but a couple times a year, we offer what we call quilt evaluation days, where we bring in an expert and you book 20 minutes with them and you can bring in a quilt and we'll tell you everything we can about it in that time. So if you've got a historic quilt that's been passed down from your family and you're wondering, you know, when it was made or what you should do with it, those are really great days. They're really fun days for me. We end up seeing like 20 or 30 quilts a day, and it's just fantastic to see what's out there. We also have some other fun programs coming up. There's one that we'll be announcing July 13th.
Ooh.
It's going to be kind of based around Halloween. So it's very exciting. We're also in the long-term planning stages. Our 30th anniversary is coming up in 2025. So we're beginning to plan how we can celebrate that. And then the following year, 2026, is actually the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution.
Wow. Yeah.
And so we're beginning to think about how we can partake in that conversation that's happening both at a statewide level, but also at a national level within the museum community. So I'm hoping both of those ideas we'll be talking about. Hopefully by the end of the summer, we'll have some big announcements of some really exciting projects. I probably shouldn't say anymore.
She's not going to let the cat out of the bag yet, Laughers.
I wish, but follow us on social media and you'll be the first to know.
That's right. You have these quilts here, and quilting is very personal.
Mm-hmm.
And they reflect personal stories and emotional connections. I would love if you could share any remarkable stories or anecdotes with the Laughers about the quilts that are housed here in the Quilt Museum.
Yeah. So one that I can tell you about is one that we have on display right now, and you got to see it. It's, we call it the Brashears Baltimore Album quilt. And Baltimore Album is just a style of quilt. It was really popular in the early 1800s, up kind of through 1850s or so. But this specific quilt was made between 1848 and 1859. And it was made in memory of Joseph Brashears, who was a ship captain who was unfortunately lost at sea. His ship, I don't know if it went down in a storm or wrecked or what. But so his friends and family made this quilt in memory of him. It's stunning. It's these people knew what they were doing. They were good quilters. The craftsmanship on it is extraordinary. It's also been pretty well preserved. There's some staining on it, but the fabric's still in pretty good condition. It also, on a lot of the different squares or blocks, there's writing on it. So they actually wrote on it, and there's a dedication to Joseph Brashears. There are the names of some of the people that worked on it. And then the quilt was actually passed down through his family, and each generation it went to the person in his family that was named after him. So either Joseph or Josephine. And then it was donated to us in 1998 when we were still a very new museum. So it's knowing that much about a quilt is really, especially one that old, is really spectacular. But I also just love that it was made in honor and memory of someone. I also really love that he was a ship captain and there's no ships on this quilt, but there's two horses.
There's two horses there for sure.
So
we were talking about that. We were trying to figure that out. He was a merchant.
Yeah. He wasn't in the Navy. He just owned a ship or captained a ship. Yeah. So other than that, we have some really great ones. There's one that we call Aunt Etta's Nine Patch. That the person who made it was, I think, 9 or 10 years old when she made it. And the family history of that came down with it is that a lot of tears were shed over this quilt because her older sister, who was overseeing her making this quilt, kept making her tear out stitches that weren't good enough.
Bad older sister.
So just that little bit of a personal story,
yeah,
and knowing that it was made by someone so young when she was learning how to sew and learning how to quilt is really fun. And that was another one that was passed down through a family. So we have that family history.
Yeah. Siblings.
Yeah. They're rough.
She got it done anyway. Good for her. I'm proud of her too. Yeah,
me too. And it's like a full bed size quilt. It's big.
Yeah.
So she wasn't just making like a little doll quilt or something. She.
Oh, that's a testimony to her determination.
Yeah.
For sure. The history in here is really magnificent. I think today one of my favorites was definitely the sewing machine room. I would love if you could speak on that. It was just, how many are there in there? It's incredible.
Yeah. So we have somewhere between 60 and 70 sewing machines in a collection. Most of them we have on display on our top floor in a room. And it's a project we're actively working on. So we have a really great volunteer named Bill, who is kind of a sewing machine guru and expert. And he actually also repairs historic sewing machines. So we're working with him to find out some more information about our sewing machines. Our hope is to get one or two of our treadle machines in working orders so that visitors can use them and experience what that would be like to use a treadle sewing machine. It's much harder than you think.
Really?
It is. We have one right now that visitors can try out, but it's Bill's that he has lent us while he's working on one of ours.
Okay.
But we have some that were toys. We have some that were children's sewing machines. We have hand crank ones. We unfortunately don't know a ton about any of them. So Bill's really helping us kind of dive into that. And also helping us evaluate that collection, seeing if we have any duplicates, if we have any gaping holes that we should try and fill. So,
was Bill the one that educated you about what you were talking to me about in that room? After I remarked, like, Singer was capitalizing, it looks like, on sewing machines. And then you shared with me that.
Yeah. So that. What Don is talking about is the history of sewing machines is absolutely fascinating and involves a whole bunch of patent lawsuits.
That's incredible.
I never knew. 1830s, 1840s, 1850s. Singer, there was another gentleman, Elias Howe, and a couple others. They were just constantly suing each other. I actually learned about that before I ever took this job through another podcast.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, through the Stuff You Missed in History podcast.
Oh, cool. I'm going to have to look that
up. Yeah, they have an episode. I don't remember if it's on sewing machines or Singer. I'm sure if you just Google it, you'll find it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But then Bill has definitely filled in some of the gaps, and he knows way more than I remember at this point. But it's... yeah, it's a fascinating history. And it's also just so funny that, like, this is what everyone was suing each other about in the 1840s. But then they were one of the first groups to make a patent conglomerate. So they eventually just were kind of like, all right, we all own this patent, because it was getting very messy and they were just spending so much time suing each other. but then Singer also became really popular and one of the most popular brands, because he was the first one to offer sewing machines on a payment plan. So yes, it was something like $5 a month to buy your sewing machine. And it was really one of the first things offered to women on a payment plan. And people had been selling, you know, farm machinery and stuff like that to men on payment plans for ages. But something specifically for the domestic sphere for women on a payment plan.
That was revolutionary.
Singer was a good businessman. He might not have been the most moral man. he had some business practices that would be frowned upon these days. But he knew how to make money.
Yeah, and I bet that was a welcome payment plan for women at that time. No doubt.
And just the amount of time it would have saved the average woman. Because if we're talking 1840s, 1860s, you're still almost all clothes being made at home. So you're making not only clothing for yourself, but your families. It takes a long time to sew a shirt by hand.
Yes, it does. A machine makes it go a lot faster. Wow. So that is incredible. I really appreciate that. I appreciated that a lot. People can visit the museum on their own Tuesday through Saturday, but I noticed you also offer special tours for groups. So if they bring a group, what can they expect? What's in store for them?
Yeah. So for group tours, we do ask that you reach out to us ahead of time so that we can set stuff up. You're welcome to just come do a self-guided tour. If you're a group of more than 10 and you pay ahead of time, we offer you a little bit of a discount on our pricing. But we also do guided tours where one of my staff or a docent will show you around the exhibit and answer some questions, and also pull out a quilt or two from our education collection and let you look at those and kind of touch those. We also do hands-on presentations. So either I or my curator, Kate Reed, leads those. And those are more, they're kind of like what we do for the teas. So we pull out 6 to 8 quilts and you get to look at them and touch them. A lot of quilt guilds really like doing that. Also, just a lot of special interest groups, and we can tailor what those presentations are geared towards. So if you're like, I love modern quilts, we'll pull our more modern quilts. If you really like applique, we'll pull applique. If you really like the color yellow, we'll try and pull yellow, although we don't have a ton. you know, and so we're always willing to work with groups. And yeah, we love having them. That's, again, it's one of the fun parts of my job, is when I get to pull out quilts and talk about them with people.
Yeah, you have a room dedicated for your permanent collection I got to see too, which was extraordinary. There's so many in there. How many quilts do you have in your permanent collection?
Our permanent collection right now is 287 quilts.
That's incredible.
So we focus our collecting on quilts from Virginia. So probably 95% of our quilts are from Virginia. We've gotten a little more specific with that over time. When we first started, we took quilts from outside of Virginia. So we do have some. But we collect all ages of quilts. So our oldest quilt is 1806. And our newest quilt was made in 2017. So
that's a span. 1806. Yeah. How big is that quilt? Or do you know roughly?
I would say it's probably like a, it would fit on like a double or a queen size bed if I'm remembering. It's not huge.
Okay.
pre-kind of 1830, they do tend to be very large. Like the one we have from 1810 is, I think, 108 by 109 inches.
Wow.
It's massive. And part of that is what, when you think about historic bed frames, they were very tall.
Right.
But then they also wanted their quilts to drape all the way to the floor because that would hide the trundle beds they had underneath the bed. So it was just a way of keeping everything nicely hidden.
And looking nice and tidy.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So much history in the way that we make things and create things as reflected here in the Quilt Museum through these magnificent art pieces. I would love for you to talk. I know you mentioned a couple of things we can look forward to and some things the cat's not out of the bag yet on. But looking ahead, what are some future plans you can share and initiatives that you can share that the Quilt Museum has in store for visitors and enthusiasts?
Yeah. So coming up this fall, we have our two Civil War shows. So our historic show, but also the work that Leslie Riley is doing. Before that, actually starting in July, we have the work of Susan Lapham, who is a modern quilter. She does really stunning pieces. She's based out of Fairfax, I think, someplace up in the northern Virginia area. We also, next January, we have an exhibit by Cindy Grisdella, who's a very well-known Virginia quilter, again, in that modern style. Beyond our exhibit schedule, we haven't started planning too much for next year. We will be open for all of those Harrisonburg festivals. And yeah, we're just hoping to keep adding more and more.
Yeah, that's actually another quick question before we wrap up here. I was just thinking about it. Is there free admission to the Quilt Museum during the festivals?
Yeah, so for Best Weekend Ever, Skeleton Fest, and Winter Wonder Fest, we do free admission. We also have free admission during First Fridays. So First Fridays of the Valleys are the first Friday of every month from 5 to 7 p.m. We're open late for those days and we have free admission. So it's a great time to, you know, even if you just pop in for 10 minutes to see what we're about for a little bit and see if it's something you might want to come back to. First Fridays are a great time for that.
Yeah. Oh, and one more thing I thought about before we wrap up here, because I thought this was pretty cool too. You have raffle quilts. What are raffle quilts?
We do. So right now we have two raffle quilts. And so you buy a raffle ticket and enter a chance to win a quilt. So we actually always have two going. So right now we have one that is called Union Square. It was made by Pat Sloan, who's a very, very famous Virginia quilter who is a huge supporter of the museum. It's a very large quilt. It's 104 inches square, so roughly king size bed size. It's a really fun blue and yellow kind of star pattern.
It's really pretty, Laffers, I'm telling
you.
Yeah,
you can see pictures of it on our website if you go under, I think, either events or support us. Tickets for that one are $5 each, and the drawing will be in December. We then also have a reproduction of one of the quilts from our collection. So that one is actually right now a small crib quilt that was originally the inspiration quilt was made in the 1890s. It's a sampler quilt, so it's a ton of different patterns and blocks all put together, but it's really fun. Tickets for that one are $1 each, and the drawing for that is actually at the end of June, so you've just got less than a month to buy tickets for that one. And you can buy tickets online at our website. And it's just a great way to support the museum and maybe win a fun quilt.
That's right. And need not be present to win, I take
it. Nope. We do the drawing on Facebook Live and then we mail the quilt to whoever wins it. And it's always one of the best phone calls I get to make. And hilariously, almost every time I make one of these phone calls, the winner is like, I don't remember what this is. And so then they're always like, can you email me a picture of what I've just won? And I'm like, yeah.
Pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, as we wrap up here, how best can the Laffers follow the Quilt Museum on social media or otherwise to connect and get more information?
Yeah, so we're very active on Facebook and Instagram. So we are posting there kind of daily about what's happening. We also do maintain an email list where we send out our monthly news and notes. So you can sign up for that on our website. Our website is also a great place to just see what's going on, and it's where you can register for any of our programs or submit a request for a group tour or anything like that. You can do directly through our website. But Facebook and Instagram is where we're most active.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us today, Alicia, and sharing with us about all things the Quilt Museum and its wonderful work today. It truly has been a pleasure spending time with you. I have learned so much. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me, Dawn. It's been a pleasure, and I'm so glad that you got to come in and see the museum.
Me too. So exciting. We will definitely be back. I can't wait. My aunt from Florida loves quilting. So next visit, I'm going to steal her away and bring her over here. And Laffers, you should come check them out too. So get more information on their exhibits and array of programs and events, including classes, lectures, historical quilts, workshops, all those things. Visit their website at vaquiltmuseum.org. That's vaquiltmuseum.org. Better yet, plan your visit in person and take a group to tour the museum and experience the creativity, craftsmanship, artistry, and history that awaits you right here at the Virginia Quilt Museum. And lastly, and most importantly, thanks for tuning in, Laffers. Out of all the podcasts out there, you picked us, and we think that's pretty darn special, just like you. Until next time, keep smiling. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by X2 Comedy. We'll be dropping a new podcast every Wednesday, so check back for another uplifting episode. Come to an X2 Comedy show or let us bring one to you. To find out more, head to x2comedy.com. Be sure to share this podcast with a friend, and until next time, cheers.